Okay, I was telling George, this is the really demanding time because it's Saturday, you just had a big meal. What comes next? No, it doesn't. I know, we'd all like to lay down and rest for a while, but let's keep going. I concluded this morning, kind of, with asking this question, given Sunday, why Friday? And again, I think you got the point, but as we make our way through the days of the Passion Week, and I give you a little outline there, I like to think, as I say, of Sunday as a day of messianic presence. It's very deliberate. I mean, that's just like to think it. That's exactly what's going on. Jesus is officially, deliberately, dramatically presenting himself as Messiah King. But given the reception he receives, why is it that by Friday the city is crying for his crucifixion? So I think if the question before the house, as I put it there, is given Sunday, why Friday, I believe the answer is Monday and Tuesday. And in order to appreciate this, I'm going to cheat on Monday and Tuesday, although they're hugely exciting days. And I've said in the past, I think if you came to me with one free ride on your newly invented time machine, I think I'd dial up Monday and Tuesday of the Passion Week. It's hugely dramatic, but we've got to cheat somewhere. But let me just take you back to the second sheet and those 10 points that I ask you to read through briefly. And number 6, I'm going to read to you here in just a moment. But I make this point that throughout his ministry, Jesus employed a remarkable strategy to unmask whatever superficial and hypocritical, the superficial and hypocritical nature of the public adulation paid him by the multitudes. I said it earlier, he has these, everywhere he goes, he has these huge crowds. And those crowds are important, by the way, and I say this down under number 8, they're important for several reasons, not the least of which is, I mean, they're important to our understanding. That's how he protects himself from his enemies. But the other more negative impact of that huge, wild-eyed popularity, superficial, that Jesus enjoyed, is that it totally confused his disciples. And he kept talking about dying and about being rejected, and in point of fact, he's ever more popular. Does that make sense to you? But Jesus has a way. I'm back to number 5 there. Number 6. He had a strategy to unmask the superficial nature and hypocritical and self-serving nature of that wild-eyed popularity. And here it is. When confronted by shallow pseudo-offers, that's my word, but I'm saying it seems like they're willing to accept him. And when he confronts that in crowds or in individuals, he would speak hard words, words which demanded a choice. And if you made the right choice, that would be indicative of obedience, but it also always involved a serious price to be paid. That makes sense to you? Now, what happens on Monday is that very, very quickly, let me just walk you through. You have a sheet on it. I'm just going to be very quick here. And I like to think of Monday and Tuesday, and I take them together. The Bible always treats them as sort of one narrative, Monday and Tuesday. And I like to think of them as days as proclamation. And what I mean by that is Jesus having, for all what we could see, for all the world, like the nation or the city had been willing to receive him, Jesus makes blindingly, painfully clear the truth concerning himself, or if you don't mind, the terms on which he will be received. Does that make sense to you? And it's because, and I got to tell you, it doesn't hop off the page to a modern Western reader. But I think if you understand the mind of the Jewish people and the significance of what Jesus does here, it's blinding. What Jesus is going to do, and here are the events. As a matter of fact, all right, I'm gonna cheat here. I'm gonna jump. As a matter of fact, let me just do this so it's not distracting. I don't know, anybody's very distracted, but let me just talk through these 2 days. On Monday morning, throughout the week, Jesus is staying in Bethany. There is remarkable genius in that because Bethany is right off the main road. There's constant traffic, so he's always going to be surrounded by crowds. Once he steps into Bethany, you know, in Jewish culture, I was telling somebody at lunch that we spend a lot of, when we're in Israel, I have a, dear friend who's also my bus driver there. His name is Nael Zadat. And Nael is a converted Muslim. And one of the things we love to do, somewhere along the line, I'll get him talking about his culture. And one of the things that he always makes a point of is that in my culture, if I receive you into my home as a guest, I am absolutely duty-bound to protect you. I would die before I would let anything come to you. That's Eastern. This shows up a couple of times in scriptures, and it kind of gut-wrenches us. Remember when the Levite made his way to Gibeon and went into the city, and he was received into a house, and the men of Gibeon wanted to do wickedly, and the host offered his daughter. And we think, what? Who would do this? It's what we're talking here. This is, by the way, what the psalm means. When it says, thou preparest a table before me, you've received me as your guest in the presence of my enemies. I can be absolutely secure. That makes sense to you? Now, how does that ramify to what we're talking about? Very simply, Lazarus and the whole village of Bethany love Jesus. So Jesus knows that the Pharisees are not going to be able to come down here and take him away by under cover of night and so on. So Jesus goes, remember, he's a fugitive, folks. He's got to handle himself very carefully. So every night he goes out to Bethany. On Monday morning, Jesus returns from Bethany. And on the way, he curses the fig tree. Now, I don't want to talk about that. It's so interesting. I'd love to spend a lot of time with it. But we talked about it before, just very briefly. He sees the fig tree by reason of the horticulture of the day. The winter figs should have been there. Those winter figs are unharvestable. They just drop, and you got to be cleaned up anyway. And so, this is somebody's fig tree. This is a cash crop here. You don't have just decorative fig trees in that part of the world because the soil is very scarce. The rabbis insisted that if you have a fig tree that doesn't bear for 3 years, you had to tear it down because it's using up nutrients that it could use. So this is somebody's fig tree, but he goes and it's not a bearing fig tree. But anyway, having said that, and by the way, it's on Monday morning as he comes into the city that he encounters and curses the tree, and then it's the next morning when he returns to the city, this Mark makes this clear, that that the tree is found to be withered from the roots up, and his disciples are amazed. All right, but leave that alone. Then Jesus goes in and he cleanses the temple. Now, I do need to, let's talk about this for a minute. I said earlier that there are four Passovers in Jesus' ministry. At the first Passover, which is recorded only in John 2, Jesus cleanses the temple. And then evidently leaves him alone for 2 years, and then at the fourth Passover, which is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he cleanses the temple a second time. Now, time out, especially for you guys who are at the college. You're going to find there's a lot of debate. All right. I think the prevailing attitude today is that Jesus only cleansed the temple once. And either John decided to relocate it for literary reasons to the beginning, or the synoptics decided for their own literary reasons to relocate it to the passion narrative. Now, that's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about. You read those narratives, and they are clearly historical. In both the synoptics and in John, they're told as historical events. Remember I told you before about this whole attitude toward the Gospels that thinks they're taking liberty with it, and that's why you can't. Many will tell us it's foolishness to think that he did it twice. I don't think it's foolish just because the Bible says he did it twice. Now, it's interesting that no Gospel records both of them. John records the second one, and the first one, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke record the second time. But I think that's the nature, as we talked about last night, of the Gospel interaction. They're very, very deliberate. Now, having said all that, I don't want to get lost in that. What's going on here? Well, I make reference to it. I want to just spend just a moment talking about the temple. This is Lane Rittmeyer's drawing. He just does marvelous, marvelous drawings. He's done more better, since. But this is this is what the Jewish people refer to as the Second Temple. There have been two temples in Israel's history. The first was built by Solomon, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Remember? The second one was built by Zerubbabel, but then it was remodeled hugely by Herod. And then it was torn down about, when they finally decided they were done building this temple. He began building in 20 BC. And in 64 BC, the procurator, his name was Abinus, said, "We can't afford it anymore, we're done." 18,000 people were laid off, and there were riots for several weeks. So from about 20 BC to 64 AD, they were working on this temple. It was leveled in 70 AD. So 6 years after they got it done, it was a pile of rubble, not one stone upon another. Now, having said that, it was one of the most amazing structures in all of human history. I could go on and on. This is an amazing piece of work, engineering work. It's staggering. You know, not Bookman, don't talk about this. But right about, hold on here, let me see. Right about here. Hold on, there's the Western Wall. No, right? Oh, I know where it is. See that arch right there? That arch is still there, just the arch right there. If you've been there, that's Wilson's Arch. If you look at the, if you stood and looked at the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, and there's an arch down by, that's it right there. And just north of that arch, there is a, all right, here's the thing. This temple is built on a threshing floor. Remember, David bought a threshing floor. Now, what's a threshing floor look like? It's a little tiny hill. Because you want to go up there. Threshing floor is where you put your grain and you throw it in the air. You want a little puff of wind to blow away the chaff. So it's just a little round hill. And that's where Solomon built the first temple. But you can't put a temple on a round hill, so you got to build up some sort of a podium, you know, an artificial platform. And Solomon did. And Hezekiah came along and expanded that platform. And then Herod did almost the unthinkable. He built this huge platform. See, all right. See this wall right here? It has what are called engaged pillars or pilasters. It's a wall that has these pillars. They're not real pillars, but they're fake pillars. They're called engaged pillars. That is the actual wall of the temple. And where those where the pilasters end on the bottom is the floor of the temple. That's where the temple was. That's the temple. That was destroyed. Not one stone was built upon another. But in order to do that, Herod had to construct this amazing system of retaining walls so he could build a platform to put that on. Does that make sense to you? That thing is 35 acres. You can get 250,000 people in there. That's huge. David's city, the city which David possessed, was 11 acres. So the Temple Mount is three times the size of David's city. Now, this is Herod's Temple Mount. This isn't the Temple Mount in David's days. Does that make sense to you? Herod had expanded it hugely. Well, in order to do that, he had to bring in huge, huge ashlars, stones, carved stones. And there's one stone, and it's exactly where it is, and it is the size it is, because they calculated, the engineers did, that it had to have that sort of ballast to support it. It weighs 600 tons. Now, that's the size of a major airline, I mean the weight. And I stood next to it one time with a fellow from Seattle. His name was Rick. I only met him on the trip. He was a great guy. But he spent his whole life on cranes. If there was a new crane anywhere in the world, they'd get him and he'd teach people how to. He knew everything there was to know about cranes. I said, "Rick, is there a crane in the world that can move that ashlar?" And he said, "Absolutely not." He said, "If I had two cranes, I could position it, but I could not get." And he said, "I know of no technology anywhere in the wide world. You could get that stone from the quarry, because it was quarried it was dug out of a quarry and then it was moved to that spot. There are other stones underneath it. I mean, it's not the top one. It's called the master course." So what I'm saying to you is that this is, and the rabbis like to say, that he who has not seen Herod's temple has never seen a beautiful building, and it's just staggering. But this is the temple at which Jesus worshipped. Now, I got to be quick. There are three courts. There's an outer court. You can just barely see it, but it's this area here. You know what? I think maybe I got some other pictures. Yeah, here we go. Here, this is a model, okay? This is that beautiful Second Temple model that's at the Israel Museum. But this is the outer court. And that was open to anybody who was interested in approaching Yahweh. Now, you can't see it real well, but I can make it out because I know what it is. But there's a what looks like a low wall here, but it is. It's a balustrade. It's a separating wall. It's called the Kotel. And because just beyond it, if you go through this little old wall and up these steps and through one of these gates here, you go into the court of the women. That's as far as underage boys or Jewish women were able to go. Make sense to you? And then you go through that gate right there. See it? It's called there's some dispute, but I think that's the Gate Beautiful. And by the way, there are 15 steps up to the Gate Beautiful. Why would that be? Remember the Psalms of Ascent? Psalm 120 to 134. God wrote a little psalm. Try it sometime. Psalm 120 to 134. And they're called the Songs of Degrees or Songs of Ascent because they're designed to be sung successively as you approach Yahweh. So you're going to make your way into the court of Yahweh. And before you do, there are these 15 psalms which the Jews understood were designed to prepare your heart for that. There are also a set of 15 steps outside right down here. And when we're there, we often do that, to read the 15 psalms of ascent on the steps, you know, as we go up. But at any rate, the point is, as you go in there, through that door right there, you're on the inner court. That's the court of Israel. That's where the altar and the laver are. That's where you actually do the business, where the sacrifice happens. And then, of course, in there is the temple proper. This is the holy place and the holy of holies. It's 90 feet high, and it's all overlaid with ivory and gold and so on. It's just a stunning. You know what, by the way? It was designed to be that. We do not offer sacrifices. And we ought to be thankful on several counts, but most of all because of Galatians and Romans, right? So praise God we don't. But that system, that sacrificial temple system, was designed by God to absolutely assault your physical senses. It was staggering. And by the way, we look even at this picture and it seems like, Christine, it was a slaughterhouse. At Passover, all right, Josephus. Everybody know Josephus, first century Jewish historian and so on, huge asset to us. But he tells a story that in 60 AD, at Passover season, for the very reason we talked about before, that the Romans were nervous about the number of Jews who were coming up. They wanted to know what kind of force they ought to have to handle the crowds, so they wanted to get some idea of the crowds. And the Jews, the rabbis, had made this demand that not, because it was so crowded, that not fewer than 10 or more than 20 people could feast on any Passover lamb. So in 60 AD, the Romans demanded that the priests count the lambs. They figure we can do by multiply by 10 and we got a baseline for how many people are coming. According to Josephus, now I'm telling you, most scholars reject this today. I'm not so convinced because we're always underestimating these people. But he says there were 215,000 lambs slain in that year. Now that's in between the evenings on Nisan 14. That's prodigious. So my point is that this was a slaughterhouse. I mean, any given day of the year. So now I leave it alone. The point is that this outer area, the court of the Gentiles, was, and by the way, this wall that separated the court of the Gentiles from the court of the women, it's called the kotel. It's called the middle wall of partition. Do you remember that phrase? That's what Paul has in mind. He's talking about what God has done in this age, and he says he has torn down the middle wall of partition between Jew and Gentile and made of the two one new man. That's not just a abstract concept. There was a matter of fact, on that wall, there was every so many feet, there was a stone with an inscription. And the inscription said, let any Gentile know that he will be responsible for the death. They're called the Thanatos inscriptions. They found 1.5 of them in the rubble. But that he will be responsible for the death he will certainly experience if he passes this wall. That's how serious it was. And Jesus has torn down the middle wall of partition. That's Ephesians 2 and 3. But I leave it alone. The point is that at Passover season, I got to back up one more. When you came to Passover, you had to bring a lamb. Now, it didn't necessarily, you didn't have to rear the lamb. Most didn't. Didn't have to raise, I should say, the lamb. Didn't have to, but you could buy the lamb, pay market price for the lamb, but it had to be a real sacrifice. Remember the old story about the pig and the pig and the hen going down the road, and it says, benefit breakfast, charity breakfast, ham and eggs, and the hen said, we should make a contribution. The pig said, for you, it's a contribution. For me, it's a sacrifice, you know. that's the old story. So the point being, it had to be a sacrifice. But most people would buy a lamb. Now, what had happened is this. the temple belonged to the Sadducees. That is, they had bribed Rome, and they had been given control, this party of what in the Bible they're called chief priests, but we remember as the Sadducees, and they run the temple. And they had realized that there was a pretty easy setup here, because when you purchased your lamb, the first thing you had to do was take it, no, I say by a certain date, you had to take it to the priest to be accepted. And so they simply decided that they would not accept any lamb that was not sold by shepherds whom they had licensed, as it were. Well, that means they were getting a kickback, you understand. And everybody knew this. And the Jews just, I mean, the common man just resented this. I always say, you imagine this scenario. You're going up, you made a long trip. Most people only got to Passover once or twice in their whole lives, but this is your year, and you've come from a long way off, and so you stop along the way, and somebody's offering you a lamb, and you buy the lamb, and you know the Levitical requirements. You can look, you can see it's a year old. You can see that it has no blemishes, a fine lamb. So you buy the lamb, and now you comes the day, and you take it to the priest. The priest says, nope, I'm sorry, no good. What do you mean, no good? Look at it. There's no recourse, there's no appeal, you know. I'm telling you, I'm not taking that lamb. Now, there's a guy right over there, may see a certain family resemblance, you know what I'm saying? But I think he may take your lamb in trade. So you go over and you get a little bit for your lamb, but now you got to pay above market for that lamb. And very possibly, because I think 1 Samuel 1 is echoing here, 1 Samuel 2, the whole Hophni and Phinehas thing. I think there's a deliberate link here. And very possibly, the lamb you're given is not even Levitically acceptable. But now you're going to go to God with you can imagine. And then as you leave that day, you look back and some poor schmuck, you know, is buying the lamb that you couldn't use, you know, just a little while ago. It was all of that and more. That's what I'm saying. I made that scenario up, but it was all of that. And the people despised it. But you can't go down the street and start the Second Baptist Temple. You know what I'm saying? You're stuck with this one. So now here's my point. There are two times in Jesus' ministry when he walks into the temple and takes a scourge and starts to drive those animals out and overthrow. Most people believe, for what it's worth, that this will work too. Right here, this fixture right here is called the Royal Stoa, or the Royal Porch. It was staggering. It had some, I can't remember the figure, like almost 100 pillars that were about, I think about 40 feet high. Each had in the culture of the Bible, the single most important architectural element for beautifying is the pillar. We think of a pillar as holding the roof up. That was very, very secondary. Does that make sense to you? Can you picture a Roman city with the agora and all those pillars and so on? The way you beautify a building or a city is with these pillars. That makes sense to you? See why that's important, by the way? 1 Timothy 3, the church, the local church, which is the pillar and ground of the truth. If the truth is going to be made beautiful to a fallen world, it's going to be because of the local church. Now, it's also the ground. That's what keeps it from... So if the truth is going to be preserved, because of the local church. It's not because of the seminaries. It's because of the church. That's what God raised up. But that's an aside, isn't it? So at any rate, let me. I said it was going to be quick. Jesus comes into the city. He had done it at the very beginning of his ministry, and now he does it again. Now, I am going to suggest to you that I said earlier, and I wanted to wait till I got here to develop it, but I think this is a very, very important element of Jesus' strategy as to... You know, I asked the question before, how did he get away with it? Here's a little chart, and I don't have a spot for you, but maybe you can find a spot in your notes if you want. Do as you will. But here's a little chart that I think is important. There's a lot more to be said about the Pharisees and Sadducees. When you come, this will help you with what we're talking about here. When you come to the New Testament, the Gospels, you encounter these two groups, the Pharisees. Who are these guys, the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Well, here's the simple, down and dirty answer. It's a little chart. So let's talk first of all about the Pharisee. The Pharisees, their area of influence is the synagogue. Now, does everybody understand? The word synagogue simply means gathering place. We don't know where. In the Old Testament, there are no synagogues. When we get to the New Testament, they are all over the place. And they're not little temples. There's nothing to do with the temple here. There's no offering here. The priests don't officiate here. The priests don't have any standing in the synagogue. The synagogue is simply a local gathering place where your whole life, both your religious life, because you go there to pray and to hear the scripture read and so on, and your social life and your economic life, this is where you'll go to find work and so on, is in your synagogue. Your synagogue is the center of your life. That makes sense to you? And there are synagogues everywhere. Did I mention that to you? I was talking about somewhere. You want to be able to go to the synagogue on Sabbath, and you can't walk more than a mile and two-fifths. So in every neighborhood, there's going to be a synagogue, because you've got to be able to get there. But you can't have a synagogue without a copy of the Torah. And you can't go down to Barnes & Noble to get your copy of the Torah. You're going to have to hire a scribe. Now, there is, and this is a pretty conjectural, but there is a rabbinical requirement that wherever you have 10 male adult Jews, and what it says is who can make a quorum, but I think it means who live close enough that they can get together on Shabbat, wherever you have 10 male adult Jews, you have to have a synagogue. And I think very possibly, this is the conjecture, it's not mine, that the reason for the 10 is you can all tithe, as it were, and hire a scribe, because you've got to have the scribe to produce the Torah. Now, the point is, the scribes were almost to a man of the Pharisaic mentality. The scribes loved the Pharisees. So in a very de facto sense, it's not de jure, it's not anywhere, you know, written in law, but the synagogues were in the thrall of, they were controlled by the Pharisees. Let me say about the Pharisees real quickly. The Pharisees, it wasn't a political party, it wasn't a guild or a fraternity. It was just a loose fraternity of full-time law keepers. That's what it was. You were full-time. You didn't work. You just kept the law. The Jews believe, I was in Israel just a few months ago, and a guy was on the trip, had a friend who had graduated with him from high school and then made Aliyah, and he was studying to be a rabbi, and he'd come and sit with his very unsaved. And it was very, very interesting. Almost every night in Jerusalem, he'd come and we'd sit and talk the night away. But this fellow, I don't remember his name right now, but he was so adamant about this. The Jews, the Orthodox believing, the Orthodox serious unbelieving, unchristian Jews, believe that God gave two laws at Mount Sinai. One is the written law, the other is the oral law. And the oral law has been passed down. And of the two, the most important is the oral law, because it's the rabbis who teach us what God meant in the written law. So, as a friend of mine over there in another time said, he's not a believer, but he said, because we were talking through things, and I kept saying, Daniel, just tell me let's look at what the Bible says. Don't tell me what this rabbi and that rabbi from the 12th century said. What does the Bible say? And he said, Doug, he who does not know the fathers does not know the scriptures. You know, that was, you got to access the, so my point is, that you have not only the written law, but then you have all of these oral laws which have been passed down, and they are just, they number in the thousands, and they're more tomorrow than they are today. And it's the stuff of Phariseeism to be more punctilious about more of their laws than anybody else. That's all they do, is keep the law. Does that make sense to you? Study it, tell you what it means, and so on. And you know what? There's a profound sense in which the Pharisee does it on your behalf. You can't do this. And so we find it very odious that here comes this Pharisee, and he's got his very distinctive clothing on, and he comes out with a little servant, and he gets out his little garden vegetables, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, and he gives the little tithe of each of the little leaves and so on, and he does this very publicly, and then when it's time to give the alms, he blows a little trumpet, people come along, and we think, my goodness, how distasteful is this? Yeah, I find it just as distasteful, but the common man didn't, because this is we're trying to please God. We please God by keeping the law. We don't have time to do it. These people give their whole lives to it, and somehow we ride in their coattails. That's all going on there. Does that make sense to you? But the Pharisees, and that's, and I say their area of influence was the synagogue. They believed both the oral and written laws. Matter of fact, they gave themselves entirely to the oral law. But the other thing is, with regard to the people, they were respected and feared. Now, folks, this is so important. They were respected because, for just what I said, they're just professional law keepers. On the other hand, they had tremendous influence. And if they were mad at you, what could they do? Do you remember? John 9, the man born blind. If you don't confess that you were never blind, what? Do you remember? will put you apo synagoge, will put you out of the synagogue. Now, don't be getting tossed out of, you know, Grace Bible Church, right? Grace Community Bible Church. That's serious stuff. But we're talking an issue of a different exponential order when you're talking, because your whole life, you're probably going to have to find another village. You're not going to be able to find jobs. It is serious business to get expelled from your synagogue. It's so much more than your worship house. You know what I'm saying? It's your union house. It's your social club. It's everything. So that's the Pharisee. On the other hand, real quickly, let's talk about the Sadducees. Do you recall the most famous reign? No, do you remember in the Old Testament, there was a time when there was a priest by the name of Eli. And where's Hannah? It was the priest to whom Samuel was given over, of course. And he was an illegitimate priest. He really was. He was of the wrong son of Aaron. Aaron had four sons. Remember, the high priest was to be the eldest living son of Aaron. But it was supposed to come from Aaron's oldest son. Well, you remember, his first two sons don't count. Remember those two guys? Ithamar? No. Nadab and Abihu. And they were the guys who, I like to say, remember that, all right, here's the scene. Moses is about to make Aaron the high priest after God's orders. Well, they happen to be brothers, so it looks a little nepotistic, right? So God contrives a way to make it clear that this is his choice. And he says, Moses, I want you to go in, and first of all, lay an animal on the altar, the glory cloud's behind you. Go into the temple, put the priestly garb on Aaron, then bring him out, have him actually lay the altar there, and then step back, and the glory cloud opened up and fire consumed that. Remember that? And I like to say, then what happened is Aaron's two eldest sons, who, by the way, had fallen in love with the wickedness of Egypt and had no intention whatever of leaving those gods for Yahweh. They'd be priests. This was a good gig for them, but that's the strange fire. So they bring fire from a pagan altar and put it on there. And I like to say God shortened up his aim just a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Because now fire doesn't consume the altar, it consumes the worshiper, you know. And so Nadab and Abihu were cinderized, and that left two sons by the name of Ithamar and Eleazar. Ithamar should have been, the high priest should be from the line, Eli was from the line of Eleazar. I'm telling you way too much. But God, because of Eli's wickedness, remember, because of his carelessness, I should say, an unnamed prophet and then Samuel come and say, there's not going to be an old man in your house. God's going to raise up a faithful high priest. He's going to raise up a faithful priest. That priest, as it turns out, and there's quite a series of vicissitudes to bring this to pass, but that priest is a priest named, do you know? Zadok. Now, to the Jewish mind, the priest, and Zadok is a descendant of Ithamar, the older of the two brothers. And what happens, he's the priest that Saul chooses when his high priest runs away. And so when David dies, he tells his son Solomon, be rid of Abiathar, and Zadok's your priest. And when Zadok becomes the high priest, 1 Kings 2, it says, thus was fulfilled what God had said to the house of Eli. So where am I taking it with all of that? That's so much background. But the point is, I think, and most do, this is not, I didn't make this up. In the Jewish mind, the one who has a right to the temple, the legitimate priest, is Zadok. See the point? Sadducee is a corruption of the word it means Zadokite. Now, they weren't Zadokites, they weren't descendants of his, but they made that claim to sort of validate in the popular mind the idea that they had a right to control the temple. That makes sense to you? So I'm just trying to help you. It's kind of abstract, but when you think of the Sadducees, think of the synagogue and the common man. When you think of the Sadducees? The Pharisees. Pharisees, synagogue, common man. Sadducees, temple, Zadokites, and they are despised by the common man. Now, the rest you can see. They're functional unbelievers. They don't even believe in the resurrection. You remember, they're very Hellenized and so on, and they are despised, and they returned the favor. They didn't care a fig for the common man. They could do it. They made merchandise. They publicly, high-handedly made the most awful merchandise of the common man. But that's all right. They were rich and so on. Now, let me take a little further. The point is simply this. Jesus cleanses the temple. All right, now let's go back. Let's put the whole thing together, if it makes any sense at all, with what you know now. Jesus, how does Jesus get away with, for 3.5 years, making the case that he is the king of Israel? I'm saying to you, I think central to it is the genius of these two times when he cleanses the temple. Because number one, at the very beginning of his ministry, within just a few days of when he emerged from the wilderness and John the Baptist said, "Behold the Lamb of God," and then he goes up and cleanses and changes the water wine. But now he comes down and Passover arrives, and very early in his ministry, when he's very little known, he goes and cleanses the temple. Now think about this. That quick, he is the absolutely the nation, he catapults himself into notoriety and fame. This is a Passover. Passover is a pilgrimage feast. People are coming from all over the world. What are you going to go home talking about? This crazy Nazarene who walked in, you can't believe, he started throwing everybody out. He catapulted himself in, but how did he get away with it? All right, remember what we talked about before. If he's that wildly popular, then his enemies, who at this point are only the same. Let me ask you, how do you think the Pharisees felt about that? They thought that was the greatest thing they'd ever seen. I think for a little while, Jesus was a huge hero with the Pharisees. Remember how the Pharisees hated the Sadducees? The Pharisees hated what went on at the temple? You got to think, they were delighted. All right, so Jesus walks in. He catapults himself into notoriety, but he angers some of the most important and powerful and influential men in Israel, the rich chief priests, the Sadducees. How do you get away with that? He's so popular that they can't just grab him and haul him behind a house and stone him. So they got to get the Romans involved. The only way to get the Romans involved is through the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin, those 70 men who decide everything, it's half Pharisee and half Sadducee. So he's deliberately set the Sadducees against the Pharisees. That makes sense to you? Later on, Paul's going to do this. He's going to be all between it before the Sanhedrin. He's going to say, "I'm only here for the resurrection," and the Sadducees are going to start duking it on with the Pharisees, and Paul's going to slip out the side door. I think he learned that strategy from Jesus. This was a masterstroke of genius. He angered the Sadducees, delighted the Pharisees, absolutely crippled the attempt, any effort to get them to move the Romans against Jesus. But now, for 2 years, Jesus leaves the Sadducees alone. He never goes back to the temple. I don't know if he went to the temple, but he never goes back and cleanses the temple. But what is he doing? Synagogue to synagogue. And you can watch this happen on the pages of Scripture. There's a certain amount of conjecture in what I'm telling you here, but there's no conjecture here. That during his public ministry, Jesus more and more angered the Pharisees. And it's only the Pharisees. The Sadducees are not in this picture. It's the Pharisees who are so angry with him, and they're chasing him down, and they're getting more and more angry and so on. I think the Pharisees are probably going back to the Sadducees and saying, "You know what? You were right about this guy." But the Sadducees are saying, "Hey, when it was our ox getting gored, you were nowhere to be found. You're on your own, guys." Does that make sense to you? I think that's what's happening. He's deliberate. But on Monday morning, think about this. Jesus returned, and for a second time, now he skipped two Passovers, but for a second time, he cleanses the temple. What's he doing, folks? He is deliberately galvanizing the anger of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. He is deliberately signing his own death warrant. I think he knows what he's doing. It's going to take him 5 days to get him on a cross. It's staggering. Listen, on Tuesday night, where I should have been a long time ago, but on Tuesday night, after these two exciting days, the Sanhedrin, Matthew 26 and Mark 14, are going to gather at the home of Caiaphas, and they're going to say this: "We have to put this man to death." As a matter of fact, as long as I'm referring to it, look at Matthew 26, because there is something which, if you understand the dynamics of the first century, it just jumps off the page. It takes you it shocks you. And that is in Matthew 26 and verse 1, where it says, he says after 2 days, and then verse 3 is what I'm after. "The chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people." Now, the chief priests are the Sadducees. The scribes are basically the Pharisees. they can't get along on anything. But now they agree on one thing. Jesus has to be dead. That's what they're doing. They're getting together. And the fact that on Tuesday night, now, and I'll tell you something else. They're going to confess right there in that verse, we can't do it during the feast. And yet Jesus is going to die during the feast. We can't do it unless there be a riot among the people. It's almost unimaginable to us the risk they took and the steps they had to take and the expense it must have been to them to contrive to get Jesus dead. Why didn't they just wait until the next week? Because they were so beside themselves with anger. The Pharisees were angry because several weeks ago, after the raising of Lazarus, they had put a price on Jesus' head and said, that man is to be arrested wherever he is, and they couldn't imagine that he could even get near Jerusalem, and on Sunday he rode into Jerusalem and the whole city welcomed him as a king. The Sadducees are beside themselves because this temple, you know what, if the government, which seems to be more and more, you know, deliberately and capricious, if the government were just decide, for reasons it doesn't have to explain, that this year all retail business had to close down the day after Thanksgiving, couldn't open again until January 5th. What do you think? That'd be hard on the economy and so on? For Jesus, for 2 days to shut down the Sadducean traffic, this is hitting them where they know they've been hit. But so the Pharisees were already so mad they couldn't see straight. Now the Sadducees are just as mad. Do you see what I'm saying to you? This is deliberate. This is not, I don't believe it's capricious. I don't think it's a matter of pique. Jesus is deliberately, he's playing his enemies like a three-string fiddle. I'm telling you. That's what's going on here. Banjo, whatever it is. All right, let me go a little further here. So he cleanses the temple, and then remarkably, for 2 days, he possesses the temple. Now, this is where I'd love to spend a lot of time. It's intriguing, but I've already referenced it, so I'll just say very quickly. Mark says that Jesus would not so much as allow a man to carry a vessel through the temple. You can imagine from what we saw before that, you know, if you're going from one quarter of the city to the other, and it might be cut short, take a shortcut going through, Jesus wouldn't have it. This is a huge area, 35 acres. Whether he assigned his apostles to various parts, we don't know. All it says is, for 2 days, Jesus took control of the temple. And he began to teach. And remember those porches, those pillared porches that were all around? We saw the one to the south. Those were deliberately designed as places where you could gather and you could teach. And there were some places where the acoustics were rather remarkable and so on. Plus, people in this day were used to an oral culture. They were used to listening. They were used to even passing things along and so on. And Jesus is basically the only show in town. And there are tens of thousands of people hanging on every word. And his enemies decide they're going to catch him in his words. And so they dispatch people deliberately to catch him in his words. This is what I talked about before. This is from a Jewish perspective, from the culture that is being played out. And this is so dramatic, where first of all, the Sadducees come. And again, there's more to this than you might see, but tell us by what authority to do these things. They want him to say Messiah. Jesus, in a masterstroke of rhetorical genius, argues them into a corner. And this is so consonant. I got to tell you, a rabbinical training school today is called a yeshiva. Y-E-S-H-I-V-A. And I for years I wanted to get into a yeshiva just to witness it. And finally I was with a guy, and he knew of a yeshiva, and it was kind of in a far off place, and we went over there. It was in the West Bank. But anyway, this was some years ago. And it was there was a loft. That's why we could go in there, because there was a loft where you could stand. It was glass and everything, so you weren't really in the room. Well, we could see everything that was going on, and he was showing us around. He was one of the students that was showing us around. And it was a room about three times this size, and it had nothing but two-sided desks like this, you know, face-to-face all over the place. And he said, what would happen is in the morning, we'd all come, and we would be assigned, you know, paired off in twos, and one student here and one student there. And then he said, we never get any lectures, but the rabbi will come in, and he will pose a difficult question. And it'll always involve maybe a conflict. And this is the illustration he used. He said, for instance, say the law says that if you've got an ox that gets loose and rips up your neighbor's garden, you got to pay for the garden, right? Law says that. Well, what about if you got an ox and you went down to the store and you got a good stout rope and you had your ox tethered, and he broke the rope and he ripped up your neighbor's garden? Who pays? The guy who sold you the rope or the guy who owns the ox? So Isaac, you stand here, and Reuben, you stand here, and you take the guy, you defend the guy who sold the rope, and you defend the guy who owns the ox, and you go at it. And I'm standing up here looking, and you just got these, you watch Jews. You got these two guys going, running around, and they're all along the wall are these tomes, with the big Talmud, and they're going and plopping them down, and he said the rabbi just walks around and listens, and then he said a lot of times about halfway through the day he'll say, okay, switch sides. And so you go at it from the other direction. And you're just taught to work to catch your neighbor, your opponent, in his words. See the point? And this is all about, Paul was good at this. That, you get good at anticipating your neighbor's argument, right? So Paul says, wherever sin did abound, grace did the much more abound. Ah, you're going to say, well, let's sin in order that grace, God forbid. You see, that's rabbinical. And there's nothing which is more noble and worthy and admirable in Jewish life than that capacity. That makes sense to you? And for Jesus to get... one other time. So my buddy Bill Schlegel, who lives over there, runs the IBREX program. He says to me one time, Bookman, I know you like to do this. And there's a yeshiva right in the middle of Jerusalem, in the Jewish quarter. And they wouldn't let us, very Orthodox, they wouldn't let us in there. But there's a patio, and they'll often drag their podia out there, and they'll stand there and do it. And I think if we just wandered over there, a couple of students. And so we were over there and watching. Sure enough, these two guys come dragging the stuff out. So Bill speaks Hebrew like nobody's business. He walks up, and he says, yeah, come on, buddy, we just want to listen. Is that okay? And the curious thing is that as he listened, he recognized that they were not native Hebrew speakers. And he said, you guys are English speakers, aren't you? How about you do this in English so my buddy can understand? So we stand there for 20 minutes, and they're going back and forth, and you got it wrong. You quote this right. Nah, that's not what he said. And finally the teacher came out and shooed us away. But before I left, I said to the guys, I said, could you tell me? I couldn't make it out. I thought maybe I could, but I said, could you tell me what the problem was posed to you this morning? And they said, oh, yeah, it's this. If a man steals a loaf of bread, tears a piece off, puts it in his mouth, thinks better of it, takes it off, puts it back in the loaf, gives it back to his neighbor, has he stolen a loaf of bread? And that's what they were going about. I mean to tell you, they were after each other. So, and I'm telling you, that is rabbinical reasoning, and Jesus proves himself an absolute master at it. That makes sense to you? Honest to goodness. After he answered that way, and the Sadducees put their head together, and they came back and said, we don't have an answer. And then the Pharisees came with, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? Show me a coin out of your pocket. One, the other. And after he says, render to Caesar the things of Caesar, God's things of God, it's the Pharisees who look to him and say, Master, you've answered well. We don't know what to say. Oh, look. And then the Sadducees, evidently suckers for punishment, they come back with the silly woman with the seven husbands, and one dies after the other. I think she's poisoning the soup, I always say. But the point is that, in the resurrection, chortle, chortle, we got you here. No answer for this. Whose wife should it be? You do err not knowing the scriptures. Here's a curious thing. The Sadducees rejected all of the scriptures save the Torah. They didn't accept any of the prophets. Now, they really didn't accept any of the scriptures. But they had control of the temple. And one of the books in the Torah, the five books of Moses, Leviticus, tells you to go to the temple and pay your tithes. So they knew where their bread was buttered, and so they gave lip service to the Torah. I think Jesus is playing by the rules. I really do. I think it's okay. I'll argue. And because if you were to ask any of us to prove the resurrection of the Old Testament, that's not difficult. You go to Daniel, you can go to Isaiah, you can go to Job, go to the Psalms, and so on. If I were to say prove the resurrection from the Pentateuch, think about it for a minute. Prove the resurrection from the Pentateuch. Because that was the argument. And Jesus, just this magisterial stroke of insight, takes him to the burning bush. And he simply says, at the burning bush, God said to Moses, I am, not I was, but I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then Jesus says this, that God's not a God of the dead. He's a God of the living. And the Bible says that after that, his enemies, this is what it says. Luke says this. After that, no man dared ask him any question at all. They'd had enough of that sport, let me tell you. Now, what's at stake there? Folks, Jesus is demonstrating his capacity to know and handle the law. And no matter what's thrown at him, he defeats the most important, the most respected voices in all of Israel. He is demonstrating messianic prowess. Now, that's not all he does. He speaks parables against them. He goes to Psalm 110 and proves his own messiahship and so on. It's so exciting. This is when after his enemies have tried to catch him in his words, there was a student of the law. Here, I'll tell you what. I believe this with two or three fibers of my being, if you know what I'm saying. But I like to think that we can identify this guy. Remember the young student of the law who came and said, which is the greatest? You know, if you wanted to, there were kind of, I wouldn't say protocols, but habits of mind where you would challenge or even, frankly, give a rabbi a chance to spread his tail feathers. If you wanted to really give an opportunity or at least even perhaps test the abilities of a rabbi, one of the things you would do, and this was a favorite thing, you would say, Rabbi, teach me Moses on one leg. Now the point is, there's a lot there, but summarize it to where you could tell me the whole thing on one leg. And that's basically what he's saying when he says, Rabbi, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus, of course, said, love the Lord thy God, the second is like unto it, love the neighbor as thyself. On this, all the law and the prophets hang. And remember that young man said, you've answered well. I mean, he even picked up on it, said, you're right, and built on it a little bit. And Jesus said, you're not far from the kingdom of God. Remember, there was a rabbi living with his sister there in town, studying at the feet of Gamaliel and so on. I think when Saul of Tarsus encounters Jesus, or the other way around, on the road to Damascus, Jesus says to him in Acts 22, says, Saul, it's hard for you to kick against those ox goads. And I think this may have been one of those ox goad moments, you know, where Saul of Tarsus is, I made that up, but it's fun to think about. But I say that just to make this point, that Jesus demonstrates his messianic prowess, his messianic authority. He controls. Now remember, this whole thing is unfolding in the temple square that he has taken possession of. This is absolutely unheard of. This is beyond our imagination that anybody would seize control of the temple for 2 days. This is so dramatic. And that is in itself a bald, dramatic, if implicit, claim to messiahship. So then go to Matthew 23, because this is where it comes full circle. Now, in order to appreciate what I'm saying to you, and I'm still deliberating the question, given Sunday, why Friday? And I'm arguing that the answer is Monday and Tuesday, and that what Jesus does on these 2 days, in effect, makes the truth concerning himself so clear and so, you know, that it has the effect of putting a fork in that city's road. You know what I'm saying? They have to make a choice. But in order to appreciate that, you've got to allow me to take you back to what I said before. That A, and there's one more thing too that I haven't said yet. But number one, Jesus had this remarkable habit or this remarkable commitment to testing the willingness, the evident willingness of people to follow him. And he did it by speaking hard words. Now, here's the other side to it. And folks, this is not something you got to suck out of your thumb. This is in the record, in the Gospels. To that end, he had a remarkably happy apparatus. And that is the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees, number one, were revered and feared by the people. But number two, they taught a law-keeping as a means of satisfying God. And so when Jesus wants to test whether or not people's willingness or their offer of fellowship is genuine, he can simply say, you choose. It's me or the Pharisees. All right, now you say, well, Bookman, where are you getting that? The Sermon on the Mount. That's what it's all about. The key verse. You think about the Sermon on the Mount. The key verse is Matthew 5:20, where he says, unless your righteousness exceed what? The scribe. You know what? I always say, in both Matthew 23, that's where we are now, And in Matthew 5 to 7, the Sermon on the Mount, you'll never understand these passages like you should unless you deliberately picture Jesus pointing. Because in both cases, the Pharisees are there, little gaggle, red necks, blue outfits, long fringe, high turbans. And Jesus, I think in Matthew 5, here's Jesus up on the hillside. Here are these multitudes of people, many of them. Luke says that morning there had been a season of healing, and there are many people in that crowd there at the Sermon on the Mount. There are people who had been carried in a pallet that morning, are going to walk home. There are people who still haven't got over the fact that they're able to see their family they've never seen before. There are blind people, deaf people, lame people who he'd healed that day. And Jesus stands, here's this little gaggle of Pharisees, and Jesus says this, you can't overstate how radical, how incendiary this would be unless your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. You know, one of the ways in which the Pharisees loved to refer to one another, they would actually greet one another, this is Edersheim, he says, as gatekeepers, fellow gatekeepers. Because they were convinced that they kept the law so perfectly that not only were they certain to get into the kingdom, but God would allow them to choose who else could get in. And they would say to them, well, morning, fellow gatekeeper, you know, because that was quite our... You know. Jesus says, unless your righteous exceeded, you'll never glimpse the kingdom of God. A gasp would have gone up. And then Jesus, all through the Sermon on the Mount, they say unto you, look, folks, I know some commentary, some preachers say that Jesus is distinguishing himself from the Old Testament. Because he uses this phrase, you have heard it said from old. Never, ever, in all of Jewish literature, is that ever used as a reference to Scripture. It's always a reference to the rabbis. And Jesus never put any distance between himself and the Word of God. He's not saying the Scriptures say, but I say to you. He is saying, you've heard them say, and again, see him pointing, but I say to you. They tell you, but I tell you. And when he gets to the end, what does he say? Picture him pointing. There's a broad way. Help yourself. Lead straight to destruction. Or there's a narrow way. You can build your house on the sand. Help yourself. Or you can build yourself on your house on a rock. That's what's going on in the Sermon on the Mount. You have that pattern. Now take that with you to Matthew 23. Jesus has controlled the temple now for 2 days. And at the end of those 2 days, and this is the last time Jesus speaks publicly. This is his last public discourse. And it's one of the most chilling sets of ideas you could possibly read. Because Jesus says, and it's so instructive. Look what he says, Matthew 23. He pronounces these woes. And he starts in verse 2 by saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. And then beginning in verse 13, he says, woe to you. Now, woe is an Old Testament word. Again, we got New Testament, you know, we got the writing in Greek, but thinking in Hebrew. And a woe is almost exclusively a condemnation which a prophet speaks against some pagan, God-dishonoring nation. For him to use that word and say, woe to you. And he never mentions the Sadducees. It's not woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees. Is that because the Sadducees weren't skunks who deserved to be criticized? No, it's because nobody was trying to be like the Sadducees. The whole thing is, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. Look what he says there in verse 13. For you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are in to go in. That's... Folks, just try and imagine how the people would have just gasped to hear this. He says in verse 15, you travel land and sea. Remember what I said about the word sun? It means one with. You travel land and sea to make one proselyte, and when you make that proselyte, he is twofold more the son of hell than he was in the first place. These are staggering words. He says down in, we won't go through them, but he says, I love what he says in verse 24, after getting after them for their hypocrisy in the tithe, he says, blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. You know what? That is hilarious. Honest to goodness. That is a word picture that would have exploded upon these people, and people would be guffawing and laughing. How do you think the Pharisees were enjoying this? Notice what he says in verse 27. This is striking. He says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs. Now, here's the thing. I mentioned to you before that that the Jews live oftentimes buried in these caves, and sometimes there might be a cave which hasn't been accessed. Nobody's died recently. It gets kind of overgrown. And there was a real problem because maybe you're making your way up to Jerusalem for a feast, and along the way you're a little tired. I'm going to rest for a minute. You go over here and off the road, and you're resting, and somebody comes along. Hey, I'm telling you, that's granddaddy's tomb. You're rubbed up against it. You're on your way to Jerusalem. Now you can't even go to the temple. It's a mess. So the rabbis had given this command that at feast seasons, all the tombs would be just whitewashed. Just take some lime and slap it on there just to identify it. Now, and by the way, take this with you, and it'll help you with this figure. To be impure, all throughout the Bible, all throughout the Old Testament, you have all these things that will render you impure. You know what it means? And just this, and you know what? The Jewish mind cannot deal with abstractions. They're not interested in it. They deal with concrete realities. And to them, the Mediterranean, you know what they call the Mediterranean Sea? The Blue Sea. I mean, it's just, or the Behinder Sea, because everything focuses east. But if it's always going to be, so my point is, when they think of something as impure, we can kind of abstract that, and it's kind of what it's. I'm not saying that's the definition, but the idea that always lays behind it is you stink. You don't like people around you that stink. God doesn't like people. So if you're impure, you're a stench in God's nostrils. Now, I like to just think about this. Jesus says, you're like so many whited sepulchres. You look good on the outside, kind of glisten in the sun. But all men got to do is rub up against you, and they become a stench in God's nostrils. Folks, these are not words that are designed to endear Jesus to the Pharisaic fraternity, right? But they are designed to drive that city to a decision. He winds up by saying, as he leaves the city, as it were, and he's going to leave. And as he leaves the city, by the way, he's going to see a woman who's tossing two mites in the alms bucket, and the contrast is going to overwhelm, and he's going to comment on it. But notice what he says in verse 32 as he concludes this. Therefore, he says, fill up then the measure of your father's guilt, you serpent, you brood of vipers. How can you escape the condemnation of hell? Folks, here's my point. Given Sunday, why Friday? I think the answer is Monday and Tuesday. And what Jesus does on Tuesday afternoon as he leaves the temple and the city for the last time under his own power. He's going to return to the city on Thursday night for the Passover banquet and then out to Gethsemane, and then he's going to be arrested and hauled out to be crucified ultimately. But on Tuesday night, as Jesus left the city, before he left the city, I should say, he pronounces these withering woes upon the Pharisees. And remember that the Pharisees are the people who, to the Jewish common man, are the very embodiment of all that God expects and all that you could do to please God. And remember that the Pharisees can make your life miserable. And I believe what Jesus is saying is, you choose. On Sunday I rode in, it was easy. You throw down your garments, you're sick of Rome, be our king. It's great. Be our deliverer. But I'm telling you, matter of fact, I like to say it this way. I think that the lesson of Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday is this. Because on Sunday, Jesus rode into the city. He fulfilled everything that the Old Testament anticipated. He was deliberately offering himself as the Savior King of Israel. And he has every right and qualification and capacity to do that. Sort of the lesson of Sunday. Jesus offers himself as your deliverer king. And he has every right to do that. That makes sense? Well, what's the lesson of Monday and Tuesday? Quite simply, the lesson of Monday and Tuesday is this. You don't take Jesus on your terms. You take him on his terms. And his terms could not be more demanding. You totally, absolutely entrust yourself to him. And these people were convinced. You know what? Here's a curious thing. They were crying out on Sunday, Hoshana, save us. But I believe their attitude, and I'm putting two and two together here, but I believe their attitude was, save us from Rome. Because they knew, they were absolutely convinced, they had no question whatever, they didn't have the capacity to deliver themselves from Rome. Jesus did not come primarily as a deliverer from Rome. That's part of the messianic role, but he is the Genesis 3 seed of the woman who's going to deliver you from the curse of sin and death. That's what he came to do. But you see, that generation was just as convinced that they didn't need a deliverer from sin and death. Matter of fact, they were offended by the notion that they needed help there. And so what's going to happen is this city is going to have 2 days to think about this. Now, think for a minute. We got to take a break here, and I'm in such trouble, we're going to have to go till 9. Did I mention that? No, I didn't. But think for a minute about the roller coaster we got going on here this week. Because to everybody's shock and surprise, and it works only because Jesus had orchestrated it in a way that I don't think probably anybody understood. He had alerted the city to his coming. But say you're one of the apostles, and when you left Perea to come over to Bethany to raise Lazarus from the dead, you thought, this is it for us. You know, I might as well say goodbye to the wife and kids because it's over. And now you've made this strange trip and you've come down and you're staying at Bethany and you wonder what's going to come next. But on Sunday morning you get up and you fetch the donkey and you walk and the whole city is there to welcome you. You're saying to yourself, oh, this is good. We're on a roll here, right? Now it gets even better. Because on Monday morning Jesus goes in and claims the temple for heaven's sakes. What is this? And then for 2 days he puts to silence all of his enemies. And you're saying to yourself, we are on a roll here. Now, on Tuesday night, you go back to Bethany. There's some adventure we'll talk about after the break. I think Wednesday is a silent day. Thursday is that blessed high day of the Passover. And here's a curious thing. Jesus arranges, you know, I got to tell you, what the Bible demands is that the Passover be slain at the place where God had put his holy name. Now, the way the rabbis interpreted that, and I think justly, is you had to be within eyesight of the temple. You can imagine that Passover with these hundreds of thousands at least, and maybe even millions of pilgrims who would come in, they couldn't find housing. So most of them stayed on hills. They make little temporary. Now, the Bible says that when you take the Passover, you must have it slain between evening, then you take it home, and you go indoors. Remember that? But indoors could be just a little, you make yourself a little temporary thing with a piece of canvas over the top. You go in there with your family, and that's where you have the Passover. And that's probably what the disciples were used to. They weren't. But on Thursday night, Jesus takes them to a house with a large upper room furnished for the feast. This is a palace. There is strong possibility that the disciples had never been in a house like this before. Now, if I'm one of those disciples, I don't know where he's taking us. We leave Bethany, we make this long walk, we start up on a western hill, we think, what's going on here? Man, what are we doing up here? This is the high rent district up here. You get up there, here's the house, you go up inside. You're thinking, we are on a roll here. This is good stuff. Now my point is, then Jesus begins to talk about dying, he talks in the upper room about how you got to be ready. Judas, for some reason, takes off. And you go out to Gethsemane where there is a cave where you often sleep. And so that's why I think he went to Gethsemane. It was a place that it was open to him. It's not a public place. It's a hobby farm. Somebody owns that, but there's a cave. I can take you to the cave. And I think often in John 18 says Jesus and his disciples often stayed there. So you go out to Gethsemane. Oh, man, this is exciting. But it's not going to happen tonight. Evidently, it's late. We'll go. So you go out and go to bed. All of a sudden, Jesus comes, wakes you up, and says, quick, we got to get out of here. You leave, and here come 600 soldiers and Judas. And Jesus is arrested. Did you see this coming? Not by a million miles. And you think, certainly, he will call the angels and put a stop to this. But he's hauled off, and the next thing you know, it's early morning, and he's being hauled off to be crucified. And now he hangs on a cross. You see what I'm saying to you? And the city. This city, which had welcomed him as king, and had watched this remarkable two-day process of Monday and Tuesday on the Temple Mount, they don't hear from Jesus again until very early on Friday morning. The word begins to spread like wildfire through the city. The Nazarene is on trial for his life. And people spring out of bed and hurry over to Herod's palace where there's this large open place where he's being tried and watch as this poor, wretched Nazarene has been beaten and misused all night long, stands there, and finally, and when the question is put to you, the Sadducees whisper in your ear, ask for Barabbas, say, okay, give us Barabbas. And by mid-morning, that man's hanging on a cross. Do you see the emotional roller coaster that's going on here? And can you imagine the depths of despair on the part of those who follow it? And then on Sunday morning, these women come to you with this crazy tale What nonsense is this? The tomb is empty? This is an amazing week. This is a staggering week. But I come way back to it. Monday and Tuesday, days of messianic proclamation. And when Jesus leaves the city on Tuesday afternoon, goes out to Bethany, that city is faced with a decision. That makes sense to you? They're going to give their verdict on Friday morning. That makes sense? I think Jesus is the only one who understands what's afoot. His disciples are fully convinced the city's on his side, for heaven's sakes. But Jesus knows better. All right, well, I'm late. Let's take a break and be back at half past, okay? Work at it.